All those in favor? All those opposed? All right. All right. Treasurer's report. I tried to get Chip in. We're having some issues getting into our online banking, so we'll get that figured out. We'll have a report next month, hopefully, with how much money we have in it. That requires you to have a card, Chip. All right. Correspondence, Judy.
No mail.
No mail. All right. Guess better than bills, right? No mail is better than bills. All right. For membership, as of right now, we have 77 members. I have to add two to my book. All right. Do you want to come up and introduce the speaker? All right. Move myself all the way.
All right. Hello, everyone. This is Erica Fauch, our speaker for the night. She is the Director of Education and Outreach for the Fair Housing Center of Central Indiana. They focus on especially concerned with the private equity involvement in the housing market. As many of you probably know by now, there's a increasing trend of these corporations and private firms buying up houses all over the area across the nation for the sole purpose of turning them into rentals, stripping away sort of and decreasing the trend of home ownership that many of us have enjoyed. They conducted an investigative report and found that over 12,000 single-family homes in the county are owned by out-of-state investors, upwards of $15 to $20 million in rental payments by local families to these investors leave our economy. These entities usually make all cash offers to purchase these homes, take that home ownership opportunity away from local families. And over half of the single-family rentals in the Far East Side, for example, more than three quarters in Lawrence, and over 80% of some of these South Side neighborhoods are now owned by out-of-state investors. Large out-of-state investors have increased eviction filings rapidly from 2021 to 2022. So Erica is going to talk to us a little bit about that and how it affects not only the housing market, but everything from nursing homes to the healthcare system and so on. Organizations like that? Thank you. Illinois has eight organizations, and Indiana has us.
So we have a lot of room. Sorry, I was moving around. That was hard for you. A lot of room to do more. Okay, great. So with that, I'm just going to use my slide so I make sure I hit all the talking points. We have four programs that we do here in the state of Indiana. We have our counseling program, which is a housing counseling program. People can call in with housing issues, talk to our counselors, and they can either refer them to organizations doing the work that they need, or if it's related to something that we can help with, we will help them directly. We have an education program, which this presentation is a part of. We offer free virtual trainings on fair housing rights almost every month for about 6 to 7 months a year. And then we also have an inclusive communities program, which is more of the systemic work, which we'll be discussing tonight about some of these deeper systemic issues as it relates to housing equity in our communities. We also do some policy work, which comes into play a lot when we're talking about investor activity, because at the end of the day, if we're worried about protecting homeownership in our communities, we're going to need something that will rein in this investor activity that we're seeing really ramping up throughout the throughout our entire state, really. With that, let's see if I can get this to work. All right, so first and foremost, the bread and butter of our work comes under the Fair Housing Act, which is a federal legislation passed back in 1968 as part of the Civil Rights Movement. At that point in time, it made it unlawful to discriminate in any kind of housing-related transaction, whether it was buying a home, renting a home, getting insurance for your home, applying for a mortgage. You're not allowed to discriminate against anybody based on race, color, national origin, or religion. That was in 1968. Since then, second wave feminist movement came about. 1974, we added protections for gender or sex. And then in 1988, we added protections for people with disabilities as well as families with children. To put this into perspective, here in the state of Indiana, we see the highest percentage of complaints coming in related to housing discrimination when it comes to people with disabilities, followed by race-based complaints. That pretty much follows the national trend that we're seeing across the nation as well. But that's where we're at. 1988 is the standard that we've set for ourselves to follow. There are a lot of gaps in those protections, right? We don't have protections for example, discriminating against somebody because of their criminal history. We have a lot of issues with people re-entering from incarceration and having trouble renting anywhere because people just do not want to rent to somebody with any kind of criminal history in some circumstances. We have a lot of problems with source of income discrimination. So somebody has a housing choice voucher or a Section 8 voucher, and they go and want to rent at a property, and they're like, well, we don't want to rent to somebody on Section 8. That's a really big problem here in our state as well. So those are two really big gaps we see as far as those protections needing to be expanded. Some states have those protections. Indiana is not one of them. So we have seven federally protected classes, and what I want everybody to understand is anybody living in the United States is protected for their fair housing rights. As long as you live here, you're protected. It's irregardless of your immigration status, refugee status, citizenship, etc. And all of us are protected in at least one or two ways, right, by those seven protected classes. Also, currently, under the current Biden administration, updated guidance through HUD and some Supreme Court decisions, we do have protections for our LGBTQ community members under the sex protected class. So it's an expanded interpretation of that. It is not actually written or amended into the law in any way, which is a gap still that we would like to see updated and fixed. Here in the state of Indiana, for all intents and purposes, we don't add any protections at a state level. They do have ancestry, which is really national origin in this day and age, so it's not an expanded protections in any way. Here in Marion County, we do have additional protections for age, military status, sexual orientation, and gender identity. But that still, we're still missing some key protections there. So what does this mean? You can't discriminate based on these things, but what is a discriminatory act? What are we seeing? Right, so anytime somebody goes to, for example, rent an apartment and they're flat out refused And the reason for them being turned away is they have children, or they are Muslim, or they are Black, or they have a disability. Anytime it's because of that protected class, that is a violation of their fair housing rights as it pertains to the Fair Housing Act. Anytime you're lied to because of, based on availability, so say you call, oh yeah, we have 3 units available, come check them out. You walk into the apartment complex and they're like, oh, we all of a sudden don't have any. Nothing to say that those 3 units weren't rented between the time you did and you called and were there, but if it was because you showed up and you had a child with you, or you had a disability, or you're Jewish, or whatever reason related to one of those protected classes we were talking about, that's falsely denying you availability to housing, which is a violation of your fair housing rights. In this day and age, it's very, very difficult sometimes to uncover discrimination. It happens with a handshake and a smile on a daily basis, and we have a testing program that we use to uncover it, where we send out secret shoppers for housing, and we compare how they're treated to uncover those discriminatory acts. Anytime terms and conditions are applied differently based on protected class. So for example, somebody walks in and you're asked to go through a criminal history check, but they only do that for Black applicants. Or you're required to have additional insurance because you have a disability. Or you're required to only live on the first floor of the buildings because you have children. Or they require you to have more rooms in the apartment because you have 2 children, for example. There are some health and safety codes that people can follow, but requiring each child to have their own bedroom is not one of them. So anytime those terms and conditions vary based along those protected class lines could be a violation of fair housing rights. Anytime there's advertisement as far as preference or limitation on who a property wants to rent or sell to, that's a violation of your fair housing rights as well. So specifying no kids or no bipolars, we've seen some that say no Mexicans, like awful, awful things, right? They should be describing their property in advertisements and they should be leaving the people out of it. So advertising discriminatorily is against your fair housing rights. And then the last one is harassment, retaliation, and the creation of a hostile environment. This is where we see a lot of sexual harassment, especially coming out of COVID. There was a huge uprise in sexual harassment complaints. We see a lot of race-based harassment going on. There's a horrific case of this actually over in Pike Township, where one of the neighbors was harassing her Black and Latino neighbors, throwing stuff at them, like profanities, really racial slurs, the whole thing. It actually went viral, the news story of her throwing a yard sign at them and just like being absolutely, absolutely terrible. So that was a violation of those individuals' fair housing rights. And then anytime, you know, you're seeing, we've seen a lot of LGBTQ harassment as well, unfortunately. So those are kind of like broadly the categories of prohibited acts under the Fair Housing Act. Do we have any questions so far? I don't want to feel like I'm just talking at you, so if you guys want to contribute or share experiences, I'm happy to, yeah.
Regarding the utility assistance here, the energy assistance program, how do you determine who is eligible for that and who is not?
So the resources on that page are not things that we offer. They are things that are available to people who need them. You would have to check the income requirements on that particular program. I think that it goes based on the average median income in the area.
Okay.
And it's based on household size as well.
And regarding the price gouging, on it's mentioned here for rental, how do they go about determine the profit margins? Whether is it 20%, 30%, 50% profit margins, or is it closer to 5 after you subtract all they put into keeping up and maintenance and all that?
I'm not a property manager, so I can't begin to guess what their profit margins are. We don't really have access to financial records if they're publicly owned, which is pretty few of them, which we'll get to the investor side in just a bit. But we really don't have access to their actual profit margins unless it's publicly shared information, which they're not going to offer up freely, usually. Okay, so that's kind of the bread and butter of what our counseling and investigative teams do on a daily basis. They work with individuals who are experiencing those kinds of discriminatory acts. We proactively go out into the community with our testers to uncover it, but we also work with clients who are experiencing that, who call in and help with those situations. Anybody who is being discriminated against can file a complaint through HUD or our local Indiana Civil Rights Commission, as long as it's within 1 year of when the discrimination occurred. If it's a little bit longer, you can still file through the court system. That, however, requires an attorney, usually more expensive, but the HUD process is completely free. But both of those we can help people with who are interested in learning what their rights are. All right, so switching over some of our systemic work. So we have our day-to-day individual acts of discrimination, and then we have these broader issues that are affecting either large property owners who operate across state borders, then we work with other fair housing organizations to work on those cases. But we also look at systemic trends that could be impacting any of those protected classes more than others in a negative way. And so we've issued quite a few reports. We started out a couple years ago coming out of COVID issuing one about the rising rents and the eviction crisis that's going on in Indianapolis. And so these numbers are from 2022, but they haven't gotten better, really. But at that point in time, we found that on average, rents were being increased by $200 to $300 for families per month. So that's about a 20% increase on average. And if you think about it, who can afford at the turnover over your lease? Oh yeah, by the way, you owe $200 extra this month. Like, did their salary go up? I don't think so. We found that the salaries went up only about 4 to 5% annually. And so rents are just skyrocketing compared to what people are making. Salaries aren't keeping up. And this is driving just really hard for families in Indianapolis right now to find an affordable place to rent. And when you're in that situation, we have record low vacancy rates right now. At the time of this report, we had about 6%. We're below 5 now. And anytime vacancy rates are that low, renters are in a really vulnerable position for being exploited. So whether it's they can't find another place to live, so they put up with inhabitable circumstances, whether you're stuck in that place and can't find another place and you're being sexually harassed by your landlord, like when you have no options, you are stuck with whatever you have at that point. And so it's really a tough situation for a lot of renters right now. And then if you add into that the fact that, you know, a lot of those vacant units are one bedroom, two bedroom. So, you know, families with children are having an even harder time right now. And then add in the affordability factor and you just can't find an affordable three, four bedroom unit anywhere in the city, really. So we're really putting a lot of pressure on our rental market right now. And what we're finding from that is that increased eviction numbers during the 2022 year, that summer, we found that there were between 400 and 600 families per week, yeah, were being evicted. 400 to 600 families per week were being kicked out of their housing for one reason or another and forced to find a new place to live. And out of that report is also where we started seeing this increase in investor activity, which is kind of a recurring theme throughout our reports, which is why we ended up with a report completely focused on investors. So that was our rental report. And by the way, all of our reports are available on our website on the reports tab. You can download them in full. I didn't bring copies of all of them because trying to lug around 8 reports for enough people in this room is really heavy. So then we moved forward. Lease is typically 12 months, and with no, with, you know, what, maybe 30 days notice, they're like, oh, do you want to renew? By the way, your rent is $300 more. Are you still interested? It's still a really tough situation for people to be in. So moving along this rental theme, we started looking into tenant screening. So this is a process that all the tenants go through. They submit their application. Sometimes there's, well, most times, there's an income check, right? Some apartment complexes have, like, oh, you have to make more than three times the rent or something, those sorts of things. There's sometimes a criminal history check, a credit score check, those sorts of things, and a rental history check. And what we're finding is that there's this increasing usage of third-party tools, AI, whatever you want to call them, to bring all this information in from public sources, sometimes private sources, and pull up this report for this tenant, and then the apartment complex looks at the report and is like, yes, no, yes, no, 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 yes. Okay. The problem with this is, A, we talked about there are no protections for people with criminal histories, which makes it really hard for somebody in reentry to find housing. And we know that successful housing is directly linked to lower recidivism rates. So this is a really big issue. The two highest problems that people have with reentry are finding a job and finding housing. The other thing we're seeing with these is inaccurate reports. So not only are they pulling all of this information from all of these places and submitting this report to this landlord, but they also have nobody checking over their shoulder, really. So there are duplicate records on these reports. There are records from people who have similar names or the same names that aren't theirs. They have ones that have been expunged that may still be on there. And so it's just this escalating problem for individuals with any kind of potentially bad credit or no credit. Eviction histories, the Scarlet E is a thing. Once you've got an eviction on your record, nobody wants to rent to you, you can't find a place to live. And so we really looked into this issue because it's something that we know disproportionately harms when it comes to the criminal legal system, Black and Latino families, people of color, also people with disabilities, domestic violence survivors who sometimes have criminal history things associated with their abusive partner. Specifically when it comes to evictions, the number one factor when it comes to an eviction is the presence of children in a household. Eviction Lab has found that the largest group of people that are evicted across the nation are children. And in this community specifically, single Black mothers with children is the highest group we're seeing among evictors. So that was kind of what came out of our tenant screening report. And so we moved on, and we were like, okay, the housing crisis has pretty much been affecting renters for over a decade or 19 now. But what we're seeing is with this increased investor activity, we're also seeing it now affect the ability for people to become homeowners. And it's affecting our homeownership market. It's affecting the outcomes for people who want to become homeowners. And what that's doing is putting more pressure on our rental market. And so that's where this report comes in. And so this came out August of last year. I'm going to get a drink of water. Does anybody have any questions? So because we had seen this investor activity come up in a lot of our other reports, we decided just to do a deep dive. What is going on? What communities are these affecting? How are our homeownership opportunities being hurt or helped by this? You know, not making any assumptions. How are our renters doing because of this? And so what we found were some really unfortunate findings for our community. And that's kind of what we're going to dive into here. As Anthony mentioned in his introduction, we looked at the top 10 largest investors in our single family home market. So we're not looking at investors who own multifamily apartment dwelling buildings or anything like that. Tracking these investors is really difficult, which we'll get into. And again, remember, we have 9 people, only 2 systemic investigators. So who we can take on and how we can take them on is primarily determined by staffing. But what we found is single-family homes in Marin County, about 260,000. Okay, of those, almost 50,000 are rentals. Okay, so about a fifth. About 27,000 of those are owned by investors. So about half, a little over half of all of the single-family home rentals are owned by investor owners. And of that, over 12,000 are owned by out-of-state investors. So about a quarter of all single-family home rentals in Marin County are owned by out-of-state investors. Yes?
Do you have a breakdown for how many of those are owned by investors out of the country?
We did not break it down by out of the country. I believe the top 10 are all in the United States. But if you want to know, we put it all in the appendix. So you guys can look up the names of these companies in the back of this report and see for yourself if there are any names that you notice or that you recognize on there. And, you know, we've had several news, sorry, really quick. We've had several news agencies do a lot of great stories on some of these properties, so some of them may be familiar to you. Yeah.
How are you classifying an LLC? Is it where it's incorporated?
Are you mean how are we classifying investors?
It's in-state or out-of-state investors.
So out-of-state investors is anybody outside of the state of Indiana.
But if it's like a REIT, they can have investors in the REIT or anywhere. Is it where it's incorporated?
Right, it would be where it's based out of.
Or where their offices
are. It would be where it's registered to. Right. So and in the report, I don't want to get into the nitty-gritties of how we determine what investors are, but in the report we go through that methodology if you're interested. We talk about the LLCs, the INCs, the LLPs, the REITs, if that's something that interests you, but we're not going to really dive into that right now. So what we found, and we have like a chart of this in the report, is that of the top 10, 8 of them are out of state and 2 of them are based in Indiana. Okay, and all but 3 of them are private companies. So this is where the private public becomes a little bit interesting, because the public are required to report certain information to their stockholders. So we do have access to some of that information, but only for 3 out of the 10 of these companies. But based on the estimated average rent for single family homes in Marin County, based on the number of properties that these entities own, we estimate that anywhere between $15 to $20 million per month is leaving the state of Indiana to these investor owners. Remember, these are just investor owners of single family homes. We're not even getting into the investors that own apartments right now or multifamily buildings. $15 to $20 million per month. So how we got to this information, again, as mentioned earlier with the REITs, LLCs, limited liability, all that stuff, it's really difficult to link all these homes to one entity. So we really had to go through over 340,000 parcel records individually. And you can see them in the back here. Each of these have multiple LLCs or LLPs associated with them, and so we had to match them by ownership address, name, and all of these things individually. We went through by hand all of these records. And so since this report came out, we've linked even more entities to these investors, which means these numbers are only going to increase. But at the time of this report, this is what we had been able to analyze. And as you'll see in the back here, Progress Residential, we found over 140 different entities associated with that one investor. Vinebrook had 50 entities, and some of the others had, 20 to 30. So this is how they hide and get around loopholes in our legal system, because it's almost impossible to track how many properties they exactly own.
What are they getting around?
So this is where I'm not an attorney. We hosted this author to come into town because he explains it really well. What happens is, and this is where, this isn't just something that's happening in housing. Housing is what we care about because we're the Fair Housing Center. But these private equity firms are actually coming into a lot of different entities in our community. So healthcare systems are being bought up by them. Prison services, so phone services that prisoners use, cafeteria services that are used by the prisons, nursing homes. We're seeing it in mobile home parks as well, which we released a report on. And what they do is they buy up these businesses, and essentially, this is me explaining it again. I highly recommend reading this book if you want more detail, but they force the company to sell their assets. So they sell any property they own, and they rent it back from these private equity firms. The private equity firms drive up costs and fees. They do cost-cutting measures, which usually means laying off people and cutting quality. And they bring in all of this revenue and all this money during this time. And then as the business starts to suffer, because when you cut costs and you cut quality, their business suffers, the business can go file bankruptcy and the private equity firm can walk away with all of the money that they've earned throughout that time. And in some situations, they pawn off any kind of retirement pensions for the employees on third-party entities to take care of because it's no longer their business. So that's kind of how they walk away with money in those other industries. And what they do is they prey on industries that have no other options, right? Prisoners, they get the phone that is in the facility for them. They can't go and choose another one. They get what food is served to them. They can't go and choose another one. And so it's a really big problem in all these other industries. But of course, we focused on the single family home aspect. I'm sorry. I'll stop moving. I'll stop moving. Do you have a question?
She was asking about the microphone.
Oh, okay. All right, so what we're finding is that they are targeting some of the most affordable homes in our neighborhoods. Their ability to beat out local families with all cash offers, make almost instant offers. A property comes on the market, one of the CEOs was caught, or well, not caught, he was interviewed, saying, we have automated systems where if a property comes up that meets our criteria, we instantly place an offer. Whereas a local family is going to want to take the time to schedule a walkthrough, talk to their realtor, look around the neighborhood, all those sorts of things. And so local families really just can't compete with that kind of business model.
Businesses are buying, or companies are buying them sight unseen.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And the great thing about cash, for those who have it, no appraiser. And the appraisal process is the one process that sellers are very, very scared of right now. Because anybody who needs a mortgage needs the appraisal to come in at a certain value. And with the value that homes are selling at right now, there's a really good chance that appraisal is going to come in low. So it's a risk for them to take on any local family who needs a mortgage who would require that appraisal.
Can you go back to that comment? You said appraisals are coming in low, but prices on houses are climbing.
That's the problem, though, is the prices are climbing because the supply is low and the demand is so high, but that doesn't necessarily mean that home will appraise for that value. And that's one of the problems with the investors is they're offering all cash at, 5, 10, 20 above asking. So they're driving up prices essentially without cause, right? Like there's no real reason for the price of that home to go up 20 grand. All right, so we covered cash buyers. We found that out-of-state investors paid in all cash over 70% of the time. And that was in 2021, I think, and then it went up to 81% of the time in 2022. So huge portions of their sales are all cash offers, which again are pretty unbeatable by your average local family wanting to become a homeowner. So we continue to monitor this issue since this report was released, We've been listening to interviews by CEOs of these companies and, you know, looking at their public offerings if they are a public entity. And one of the CEOs for Progress Residential, during an interview, stated, "We have an incredibly effective system for acquiring homes one at a time. Every 15 minutes, the company gets an update of every newly home listed in the market. Their algorithm will then identify a house that meets their criteria, and the company's acquisition team will make an immediate offer within a couple of hours of a home going on the market. So we're able to analyze it quickly, make an offer. Our offers are all cash, very flexible closing, basically whatever the seller wants to move out," which are just terms that local homeowners can't, or local individuals cannot offer, right? If you have another home you're selling, you have to get them to align. If you're leaving your lease, you have to get the timing to align. You can't just be like, "Oh yeah, move out whenever, I'm here all the time." So it's just a really unreasonable situation to put local homeowners. That is not an area that we have looked into, so I'm not going to say whether I don't have any information on that. I will tell you we are seeing a huge rise in build-to-rent neighborhoods, which we are also concerned about, because the amazing thing about homeownership is you build equity, and you build nothing when you're renting. And so that generational wealth component is something we're really concerned about for those build-to-rent communities.
Do you know the mix of owner-occupied and rentals, just broadly rentals, in Marion County?
Yeah, so I had those numbers at the beginning here. So single-family homes are about 260,000 of them. Of those, almost 50,000 are rentals, so that leaves about 210 that are owner-occupied. Or vacant, I guess. We do have some vacant property issues going on as well. Okay. So, local homeowners are being shut out. Especially, again, we're seeing that they are targeting some of our most affordable neighborhoods in Marion County. If you look in our booklet, actually, there's a map of the different neighborhoods, kind of broken up by percentage, I think it's percentage, of investor ownership. And if you look at where Decatur Township is on that map, hold on, you're gonna see a really, really dark orange. And that means that the percentage of single family home rentals, sorry, I'm coming back. over 64% of single family rentals are owned by out-of-state investors in those really dark orange neighborhoods. Okay, and then if some of these other ones are a little bit lighter, then they're a little bit less. But we break it up by neighborhood so you can kind of look at those percentages. It's on page 12, if you're interested in looking at that. And so we're shutting people out of homeownership, which means they are staying in the rental market, which is hurting our vacancy rates further. People who are in that kind of area where they want to buy a home but are being priced out by investors but otherwise would have been able to are renting, but they're not renting the luxury apartments that are being built on what seems like every block. They're renting more affordable units so that they can save money to buy a house, which means the people who actually need those affordable units are now either priced out and have to go up, or they have to try and put more pressure on the lower income bracket, which is then taking more of those out. And so we're just continually pressing and pressing and pressing on these affordable units that we just don't have.
So I have another question for you.
Yeah.
Let's say you have a neighbor who is renting a house, the owners are out of state, you want to file a complaint against them. How does whoever, mayor, you know, if you go to the action line, do it there, we contact you. How do you contact the out-of-state person to tell them what's going on?
How would we contact them? So, unfortunately, what are you filing a complaint about?
They're using they've got a bicycle ramp. I live on a curve.
Mm-hmm.
They've got a bicycle ramp that's blocking the buses and everybody else that want to get in out our driveways. They were told by a police officer to put it between the street and the sidewalk, and that worked for maybe 2 weeks. They marijuana with them says that they won't, they don't want to be involved with anything because they are dealers.
So it sounds like you could file and try to file like a noise complaint or a nuisance complaint against them. If there's a homeowners association, you can kind of reach out to them.
Don't have that.
Yeah, so unfortunately what we're finding.
But I know the owner because I know his number because I offered to buy the house flat out.
So what we're finding is, right, we don't have any kind of boundaries or barriers in place to hold these investor owners accountable for anything local, right? They're not being good neighbors, right? So as you said, those things that are happening in your neighborhood, but we're also seeing, you know, a lack of investment in the properties, right? Not following basic maintenance schedules, not keeping the plumbing up to date, not making sure the AC or the heating is working, especially in the summer right now. Can you imagine being in your home today and not having an air conditioning unit working? So there's serious habitability concerns when it comes to these investor owners, and we see that in the Marion County Health Department's data when it comes to analyzing these investor owners' health code violations. And so what we found is that overall between 2021 and 2022, there was a decrease in health department violations across single-family rental of 6%. But what we found when it came to the investor owners is that theirs increased over 6.2% when it came to health code violations. So they are not keeping these properties up. In the long term, that has even more dire effects for our community, right? With the housing shortage we have now, if they're not keeping them up, eventually they'll become inhabitable. That housing unit will be removed from the supply, and we already don't have a large enough supply, so then we'll be hurting our supply even more. Vacancy rates will go down, rents will go up, and it's just this really, really hurtful cycle. You had a question.
So I'll tell you what I did. I really got lucky. If you can happen to notice when the property is between renters, you know, the maintenance company or the ownership company or whatever goes in to clean the house. And so I happened to see the guy in there cleaning out the house after the tenants moved down. I got the name and address of the local, like whoever was hired to do the maintenance and stuff like that. So I now have a phone number, a local phone number at least, for the people who are supposed to be taking care of the property. Because everything I've been able to find shows that this house in my neighborhood is owned by some company in Japan.
Yeah, so, so that is also a problem, and that's a problem that has made the news actually on the multifamily side of things, right? Do you guys remember the JPC issue that came out? I think IndyStar followed it last year, where their apartment complex was completely inhabitable. Nobody could get a hold of them. They didn't pay, I think it was Duke. Was it
the water?
Oh, the water. Was it the water? They didn't pay one of the utility companies, and how it worked at that unit, at that apartment complex, was the renters paid JPC, who then paid the water company or the utility company, but they never actually did this part of it. So they got there, they were getting threatened to have their water shut off, and they're like, hey, I'm paying my utilities, what is going on? And that took, the Attorney General, the city, and I think one more entity to finally get it where JPC is no longer able to have rentals here in Indianapolis for at least 7 years. But it took all of these agencies coming together with like full force to try and get this owner to have some sort of accountability for what they were doing here. And that's what we're trying to really bring to light is just a lot of times, if you had a local number you could call for a property management company, you were lucky. A lot of times, there is no local property management company. You are trying to call someone in California or New York, and getting them on the phone is probably close to winning the lottery because a lot of times, they're not there. And so that is a huge problem we're also seeing is no accountability at a local level, not having any kind of contact information for these entities. And that's where, again, it's hard to hold them accountable if you have no idea who you're reaching out to. Yes.
Just so people know, it can be a bit of a scavenger hunt, but if you find out that a business, that an investor's company owns the property, you take that business name and look it up on the Secretary never a phone number, but there is a local name and address for someone to accept legal documents. That could include court documents, it could include just certified mail. So it's difficult to get to them, but you can somewhat. You can at least send that certified letter, and if it ever has to go to court or anything for the Board of Health issues, you have proof that you let them know way before you reported it to the Board of Health or the city.
So I will say that part of what has come out of this work is a list of policy recommendations that we have provided with you guys here today. This is something that we can talk to our city council members about. I'm sorry, I moved again. We can talk to our state legislators about. We can talk to our Congress members and senators about. I will note that on the front side of this, there's a lot of things on here that you got to go through the state house before anything's going to happen locally. Our state house loves to preempt things. And so there are a lot of really positive housing policies that we could be implementing in Indianapolis, but we can't because the state won't allow it. So I just want to put that on there. So we list what all those things are that we would have to do at the state house, but then we also have things that we would like to see done to help curb this issue in our communities. And one of those is a landlord registry and rental inspection program.
There is a landlord registry in Indianapolis.
We need one that is required and enforceable with heavy fines if they don't. An investor owner is not going to blink at a $50 fine. Okay, and then the other thing that we want to touch on is evictions. We are seeing investor owners evict at really, really high rates compared to other rental owners in our state, or in the Marion County, sorry, all of this is Marion County. The eviction process here in Marion County, in Indiana really, is fast and cheap. It is way easier and way more bottom line focused to evict someone, raise the rent, get another family in there with 4% vacancy rates, you're not gonna have trouble finding another renter. It fits their business needs to evict people and get new renters in almost without fail. The eviction cost is really negligible for these large corporations, and the time you can kick a family out is really small as well. And so we're seeing it as a business model for that kind of activity going on. I don't know if you guys are familiar with Savvy, but they do a lot of great social justice, data-heavy work here in Indianapolis. They have an amazing article on evictions as a business model for rental landlords in our city, and it's really eye-opening. You guys should definitely check out that article if that's something that interests you. Oh, wow, we are, like, way past time. I'm sorry about that. I think you gave me 30 minutes. Why didn't somebody call me out? I could talk about this all day. So, but basically, the lens that we come out this from is we're seeing this impact a lot of really historic neighborhoods of color in our communities. We're seeing displacement of families in these neighborhoods as well. We have a partner organization of ours that does home repairs for seniors and people with disabilities who own their homes. But we're seeing large amounts of calls to the health inspector on these homes that, you know, they just can't quite keep up with. And a lot of times we don't have documentation of this, but how many people have gotten texts to say, hey, I'd love to buy your home for cash? Yeah, well, when you turn them down, if they think that they can get at you through a health department code violation, I don't doubt that they would do it.
I mean, there used to be signs like plastered on every single telephone
pole. And where we come at this from is that we really see housing as the foundation for a healthy, stable, productive life, right? Where you live matters. In Marion County, you can drive from north to south in what, 30 minutes maybe on a good day? Your life expectancy can vary up to 19 years based on which zip code you live in. 19 years. So it's a health, it's important for your health, it's important for your access to healthy food, jobs, transportation, what school your kids are going to. So it really affects every other aspect of your life. And so we really want to make sure that people have the opportunity to live where they want to live, and make that housing choice equal for everybody. And that's really the goal of our, the brunt of our mission. So I appreciate you guys chatting with me about this. Is there anything else you guys have questions on or want to share? I am sorry, I went way over. Somebody should have told me.
Right, so we'll move on. Civic Affairs, do you have anything?
Yes, just one quick announcement. As of last week, Wayne Township Fire Department has announced with a joint statement they will remain independent as they were unable to merge by January 1st as they initially planned.
Wayne Township is not merging with IFD. They are remaining independent. Their ambulance is already merged, and they're staying merged. So.
Wayne Township is merging,
Wayne Township, the fire department is not. The ambulance did.
Yeah, they backed out of it.
Yep.
Good for them.
So.
Glad somebody's got some sense there.
So the three townships that have their own fire departments are Pike, Wayne, and Decatur. So, it's all on the west side. Is that all you had, Anthony?
That's all.
Okay. John is not here. Land development, Chip.
Dollar General is having its grand opening on Saturday.
Will you be there?
Oh, there you are.
I don't know. Maybe.
Burgers.
It won't be Chinese.
Burgers and fries. Hot dogs.
It's by Menards.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay.
And that little strip off. It's not really an indicator.
All right. Is that all you had, Chip?
That's all I have.
All right. Parks. I actually have something for Southwest Way. So, September 10th. Which is a Tuesday.
Hold on. We
got conversations. Okay. All right. So for Southwest Way Park on September 10th, it's a Tuesday, from 6:30 to 8 p.m., there will be a community open house. You'll meet with Indy Park staff to give preferences for upcoming major improvements to your neighborhood park. Join us so your feedback can be heard. Interpreters are available. If you go by Southwest Way, when you're going down Manon on the left, where the baseball fields are and where the most of the park is, they do have little purple signs up in all the different languages that are on here. There's four. So there are signs in front of the park in the different languages for those that want to go to the open house, which is September 10th, so a couple weeks from tomorrow. So.
I get a postcard on that.
Yep. So maybe because we're close. I thought maybe because I'm a friend of Garfield Park. But I thought maybe that's why I got it, because mine says friend of Indy Parks, so I don't know. But maybe because we're close, I don't know who else would have gotten one. So September 10th, if you want your thoughts on, I know it's supposed to get some sort of the money from the money that came down, I forget, $80 million or something up for the Park Scout or something. So we're supposed to get some of that money at Southwest Way. So. There are some construction updates. Southwest Way, there are playground renovations and comfort station. That's supposed to start the bidding process or design process early 2024 to December, and then bid out January to March 25. So construction should start in April 25. So And that is part of the Lilly grant. So Cranard is also sort of a park that's got really the pool and the building, the family building that right now for us until we get Jack's going and all the other ones that we have going on. They are getting basketball courts, shelter, playground, and lake trails are going to be under construction, and they should be in completed in the 2025, which is also part of the Lilly grant. So I know we have the Jack Butler building, park, I don't know, what we're calling it, park? Okay, we haven't heard anything about that one yet, but they did say that they would name it that. Then we have the cards, right, with an S, right?
Singular.
Okay, so Card Park, which was named after the family that owned the farm behind Cardinal Village, I think it's the name. That's named after that family. I don't know if they're planning to do anything with it other than have it named that. But they already have a sign that says Card Park on it. So, so those are the parks right now that we have any information on. All right, let's see here. But you want to do land use or you want to go last? Rosie, do you have anything you would like to share?
I have a couple things. I left four flyers, so if everybody would just grab those. Just to let you know, there's stuff about the extreme heat we're supposed to have tomorrow and things you can do to mitigate that. IMPD Southwest District Community Day will be September 26th. It's up by Southwest District Headquarters. It's on 551 North King Avenue, but it's a great day. The Decatur Drug Free Coalition takes their trailer, the Hide in Plain Sight type trailer, up there. And just so y'all know, Amazon brings a semi full of returns and gives away. You don't get to pick through what you want, but you stand in line and you get what they give you.
And my husband will be DJ.
And if nothing else, it's a white elephant gift at Christmas. The Office of Education and Innovation, which is our oversight department for charter schools, has started a program called Circle City Readers. They are hiring reading tutors at $22 an hour. I don't know exactly what the hours are, but it's part-time work. And then Citizens Energy is going to be having a community day up at their location at 2020 North Meridian on October 5th. The one thing I want everybody here to know, besides their community day, is starting in October, they're going to start a public advertisement campaign. They have monies to help with lead pipe remediation. And most people are not going to need it because their house will have been built earlier than 1950-something. But there's a lot of farmland. There are a lot of elder houses out here. The big thing about this is where typically they do everything from the right-of-way out, and the homeowner is responsible from the right-of-way all the way to their house, they will be doing that free of charge. In order to do that, though, the first thing they'll do is come flyer. People will have to let them know they're interested, and then they have to get the property owner to sign permission for them to enter the property. The big help you all can be ahead of time is to let people know this is coming. I don't have a lot of answers other than what I've told you. So the big ask is that you let your neighbors know this is coming, and when they get these flyers from maybe the contractor that says, hey, we want to do free work on your property, they know it's legit. Okay? The other thing I have is, and I know this is short notice, this Wednesday from 11 to 1, all of our county elected officials will be at Luger Plaza outside well, the mayor is actually the only city office, but then all of the county, the prosecutor, the assessor, the clerk.
Sheriff, auditor.
Sheriff, yeah, let me. The coroner. Luger Plaza is that pretty side of the city county building off of Washington Street, between Washington Street and the city county building.
Okay.
So I know it's not convenient. I know you have to pay park if it's in the middle of the workday and the middle of the week. But all those questions you would like to ask someone face to face, this is when they'll be here. That's all I see.
I know Jason Holiday let me know last Thursday that he would not be here tonight. It's his wife's birthday, so I would choose my spouse too on a night like tonight. So he sends his apologies, but he's with his wife tonight for her birthday. So and I believe it's a council meeting night, so Josh is not here. So all right, up to you, Pat.
May not have a community announcement.
Oh, okay. When did that happen?
But the road home sign was still up, and I thought, oh, I just forgot to take that sign down, because you know those signs stay up for 6 months or a year afterwards. So I drove like halfway down. Guess what? They're still doing work. Don't call for it. Wait for them to take the road home sign down. Just because the barricades aren't there doesn't mean they're not still working.
I drove by there to get there, and the barricades are up. To the corner of Mendenhall and Canby, and the barricades were up.
Okay, well, they had like.
They were waiting for you. They took them down.
I was being nice and thank the guys for doing the work. And then I drove down and I got as far as like the next Big Dip or something. And I was like, well, dang. So I had to turn around and come back.
They were working on power lines, I think, because when I went through a couple times today, they were working on power lines or something. So they may have had them down so they could get their machine through. They were working on something on that side of the road.
They're probably videoing you.
Yeah. It's on TikTok now.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's okay. I had my hair up when I went by the one time, so I took it down. I'm not going to know it's me.
The adventures of living in Decatur Township.
It's a never-ending festival.
It is. It certainly is. Okay, we only had two things pending. On Thursday, the fence in Copeland Mills, where they wanted to change the commitments from way back. That goes to the hearing on Thursday. Everyone is supporting it that we know of, so it'll probably just be expedited. The other thing that's been kind of slowly creeping along is that Arbor Homes wants to do two subdivisions. They'll have a single HOA, but they're two separate filings. There's now 48, they've increased the acreage on the north side of Southport Road. This is Southport Road just after you leave Mooresville Road and go east. It's on the north side. And it's now 48 acres and 130 units. That's their Arbor single family line. They filed this and the petition's been finalized. And as far as, you know, the paperwork goes, and they are seeking a D4. We need to talk to them some more because the density is a D3, and also the level of the housing is of interest. But at this point, it's been filed. It's currently scheduled to go to hearing on September, I think it was the 18th.
12th.
Thanks.
I got a thing.
Okay, the 12th. I'll be putting in a continuance because we need to talk about this in detail. And at this moment, there's no commitments or anything being proposed. from their side. The other one is more cumbersome. It's on the south side, right across the street of Southport Road. It's just west of where the solar farm is, and it's 105 acres. They want to do two types of housing in there, and because of some of the details on one piece of the housing, they're going for a process called DP, and it's a planned development where you map everything out, you set all the standards, you don't go by what the ordinance calls for when you have like a D4 or a D3. So they create the whole ordinance for that. But to do that, they build up small footprint and multiple stories. They have a two-story and a three-story. They've never built the three-story in Marion County, as far as we know. So on the first floor, they have a garage. They have a little entryway and a bonus room. And then you go to the second floor for your kitchen and living room. And then you go to the third floor for your bedrooms, for the three-story one. So they got some explaining to do. We need more understanding of how this type of housing is safe, and you know, how is it going to be okay? So we will have to have some serious discussions with them. They've given us some addresses where we can go see the types. They've never built a three-story one in Marion County, but they have built a couple of the two stories, and then they have some in Lawrence Township that are the two-story kind that are on paper right now. They haven't actually built any of them, but they've been approved. So that line we'll have to discuss in some detail. They have some, because they have to write the ordinance, they have some modest standards in there. And they've taken some of them from the ordinary standards that we ask for in commitment form normally, but they've left the larger asks that we normally have off their list. So again, there's a lot of room for discussion with Arbor on these. They're coming up. This DP process, like I said, this paperwork has, for this part, hasn't been finalized. So there's no hearing date yet. But it is a different process than we usually go through. So what they'll have is they'll have meetings downtown. If you're a near neighbor, then you might get invited. They invite the fire department, the parks department, the city hall departments that have an interest in zoning and all that. And then neighborhood associations and the trustee, et cetera, would be invited as well. So that one is kind of like you go around the table, the city people first, and then with time remaining, the neighbors get to ask questions. At some point, it may take multiple meetings. They try to keep them to an hour apiece, but it may take a couple of meetings, and then they'll say, "Well, we're kind of done here. Nothing's moving anymore." So they set a hearing date, and it skips the hearing examiner step and goes straight to the Metropolitan Development Commission. So we shall have to see, but the Land Use Committee is gonna have to meet with them outside of that particular meeting as well, because of the amount of depth that we will wanna go into versus the amount of time we would have to ask any questions at that DP meeting. So anyway, that date hasn't been set, that meeting hasn't been set. Their paperwork evidently isn't finished yet on that one. But again, the one, the 48 acres on the north side, that's a straight D4 request. It'll go to the hearing examiner, but I will be asking for a continuance into October. Okay, any questions?
With that many houses that they want to put in, that's a lot of families. Are they going to build a school? Because West Newton's pretty well packed as far as I understand.
Yeah. The school is, the school's job is to keep planning. And it's their job to increase the capacity of the schools to accommodate the growth that we're seeing. And it's a routine thing for them to do. On the topic of roads, though, they did have to do a traffic study. And the traffic study came up that the intersection of Southport and Mooresville Road needed to have some turn lanes. And they were hesitant to jump into that and volunteer to do that. Something about, I guess there's a culvert in there.
There's
some kind of an issue there that makes it particularly expensive. Then also on the intersection of Mills and High School / Mooresville Road, their construction will trip that intersection to fail by the criteria of a traffic study. And so they would have, at this point, the traffic study says that their construction would contribute to a failed intersection up there. So those two intersections come up as problematic. So we'll see. I haven't talked to the traffic people yet to see what they are going to ask of Arbor in order to do this subdivision.
And I think those kids go to Blue now when they redistrict. Kids in that area all go to Blue, even in Crossfield. They don't go to Blue.
Really?
Yeah, they don't go to West Newton anymore. Yeah. So.
Yeah, but it is the responsibility of the school district to keep on top and keep their projections going, as you know, growth might jump a little bit, but it tends to have some kind of a steady pace. Okay, any other questions?
Road. So it's at the golf course, not at Southwest Way Park. Sorry, forgot to mention that. Thank you, Rosie, for reminding me.
What time is it?
6:30 to 8 on the September 10th.
Amanda?
Yes, ma'am.
Excuse me. I would like to let everyone know on September the 13th, that is a Friday, West Newton is going to be recognized with their 200-year anniversary as a settlement.
Okay.
And they're going to have a program at the West Newton School, and it'll be at 1:15. Norma Gaston is the one that's really been working on that.
Nice.
So they're going to have the children come down into the gymnasium, and she's going to explain how West Newton actually got to be a settlement. But they're not including the first, second, and third grade.
They can't sit still.
Everyone is welcome. There was some question about the schools being open, and I guess they'll have security there and everything. So.
Yeah, usually they open it at least to the parents, like when they have programs like that, like all the our Veterans Day type stuff. So
yeah.
That's cool. That's awesome.
1:15.
Amanda, repeat what you said. Where that was.
The thing, Winding River Golf Course.
Okay, what time?
6:30 to 8.
Y'all talk faster than I can write.
I'm sorry.
Oh, there it is. That's on the wrong piece of paper.
September 10th.
And I am looking into a mic for us, for the room, and so we don't have to work with the school trying to get their mic. So I've been looking, sort of. So.
Just one other thing about this at Southwest Wing. Whenever a meeting from the city is described as an open house, they have different stations set up where people can explain with pictures and stuff and take your comments. It's not a set program. So if you can't be there at 6:30, that's okay. If you can't stay till 8, that's okay too. Everybody stop by.
So, all right. Anything else to come before the council? All right. I move we adjourn.
Second.
All right. See you guys next month.